public.
Well, I love WPKN because it's 100% listener supported.
Why I love WPKN? I'm in it for the music. Out of my
head. I feel good. Hi, my name's Chuck. I invite you to join me for the Emotion Roadmap every fourth Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m., a show where you will learn to take the wheel and control how you feel. The show is about helping you manage emotions, your own, others, and your emotional relationships, especially with those people that matter most to you. I will talk about family issues, including raising children, marital relations, extended family dynamics, and aging, elder care, and caregiving. I will talk about organizational issues, including business and industry, schools, public and private, higher education, local, state, and federal government, hospitals and healthcare, military and religious organizations. I have worked in different ways in all these areas. I will teach you how to use the Emotion Roadmap to address any circumstance involving strong emotions that are complicating your life. I look forward to talking with you every fourth Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m.
So good! So good! I got a year!
Welcome to the Emotion Roadmap. Take the wheel and control how you feel. This is Chuck Wolf, and I'm delighted to be back with you this month. And I want to remind everyone that if you've got some ideas and that you want to hear on our show, please feel free to call in to 203-336-9756. And also feel free to email me at cjwolfe@cjwolfe.com. I want you to call and write in with your ideas for topics for other shows, because I know that we've been doing a lot of interviewing and we've been taking some phone calls, and this week is going to be another really good show. I'm excited about it. And last time, hopefully you remember that we had Gene and Joe on talking about what it's like to be a soldier away from home for a period of time, and it's things that we can do as community members to support those families that are providing their loved ones, their loved ones who are going over and fighting for us and defending our freedoms. When we know of families that are out there doing those things, we also know that those families are experiencing a lot of alone time, separate time that's hard to bear sometimes. And the community support is really important. And we spent a lot of time last month talking about that. We also had Dr. Julian Ford on, and Dr. Julian Ford was a wonderful guest talking about post-traumatic stress syndrome and how to use your cortex to overcome your amygdala. Now, for those of you that don't know much about your brain, there's a part of your brain that's just all about emotions and another part of your brain that's all about mature regulation of those emotions. And one of the things that Dr. Ford has discovered is some ways to strengthen our abilities to manage our emotions that sometimes seem like they're out of control. Our whole show is about that. The idea of an emotion roadmap, take the wheel and control how you feel, is about each of you learning more about how to manage your own emotions and your emotional relationships with others. This particular week coming up, this day, we are going to be talking with three different people. The first person is going to be talking with us about addictive behavior. For anyone who's ever felt either somewhat or completely addicted to any kind of substance or situation, whether it's things like alcohol, drug abuse, overeating, video game compulsion even, there are a lot of things that cause people to behave in what seems bizarre. And we're going to listen to someone, Dr. Bev Glazer, who has had an incredible success record with helping people to overcome addictive behavior. The next person we'll be talking to is a fellow named George Dumigan, who's a colleague and friend of mine. And George is actually from Connecticut, and he and I partnered a number of years ago to put together a workshop called Emotional Intelligence that George and his company have taken and translated into numerous languages and have taught all over the world. And we're excited about that. The third person we'll be talking to is a fellow named Dave Sharon. And Dave is a lawyer and someone who is also a psychologist who has a background in both emotional intelligence somewhat, but also he's a specialist in positive psychology. But he's going to talk about a time when he and I together went around the state of Tennessee, where he was in charge of continuous learning for lawyers. And we educated a whole bunch of lawyers about emotional intelligence. He's going to tell you some very fascinating information about lawyers and emotional intelligence. One of the things that he'll share that I was very interested in learning about is how many lawyers become clinically depressed right after law school. That's very interesting experience. But also he's going to talk about some of the workshops that we did and some of the impact it's had on lawyers in Tennessee and how some lawyers are doing things in a way that's more emotionally intelligent. They're learning how to take the wheel and control not only how they feel, but how their clients feel and also the people that they are sometimes litigating against. It's really interesting to hear about people who have been very confrontational and aggressive, changing their style somewhat and producing win-win outcomes with even better monetary outcomes than they'd had in the past. So lots of good things to talk about. I look forward to hearing from you. And as we always like to start our show, we're about to listen to Elvis.
There must be lights burning brighter somewhere. Got to be birds flying higher in a sky more blue. If I can dream of a better land where all my brothers walk hand in hand, tell me why. Understanding sometime, strong winds of promise that will blow away the doubt and fear. If I can dream of a warmer sun where hope keeps shining on everyone, tell me why. Answers gonna come somehow out there in the dark. There's a beckoning candle, yeah. And while I can think, while I can talk, while I can stand, while I can walk, while I can dream, oh, please let my dream come true.
Yeah, we're back live, and we're about to talk with Dr. Bev Glazer. And we're going to, I want to just say a little bit about Dr. Glazer. I met her through another person who had her son who was having a very difficult time. And this person was finding himself addicted to video games. He was losing himself in his video games at a college setting and losing his GPA at the same time. And this person found Dr. Glazer, and amazingly, after a number of visits with Dr. Glazer, her son was performing the way that she had always hoped he would. Dr. Glazer also studied with a very, very famous and favorite psychologist that I am familiar with, a fellow named Dr. Alfred Ellis. And actually, Ellis has really been an influence on me as well. And the emotion roadmap, this idea of controlling how you feel, the idea of planning for what you want to feel and being able to change your feelings was heavily influenced by Dr. Ellis's work. That's another reason I'm really attracted to Dr. Glaser and her work. And she specializes in all impulse control behaviors. If you've ever found yourself impulsive and wanting to do something that you know probably isn't the right thing, but just unable to stop, then hopefully you're going to get some guidance around that, about changing the way you feel, which is what our show's all about, from Dr. Glaser. So, are you on the phone with us? Bev, are you there?
Are you talking to me, Charles?
I am. You're live now, and you're there. So, it's a pleasure to have you on with us.
Thank you.
And I did say a little bit about your background, and I had said when we talked that I thought perhaps we could talk a little bit about just to understand the difference between a behavior that might be what some people would say, yeah, but I just do it some of the time, as opposed to when a behavior actually becomes an addiction. If you'd be kind enough to take a moment to explain when something becomes an addiction.
Sure. Well, we all believe that when we have a compulsive behavior that we're okay. And that's the strange thing about addictive behavior. I can use food for an example because everybody seems to have a problem with that. When you can notice that you're overeating, you can go on a diet, and you can lose the weight. But then what happens is, as soon as you've lost the weight, you go right back again. Now, this is what we call emotional eating. And when you are eating emotionally, it's not the food anymore. It becomes the behavior. So you can eat and eat and eat, and you're really not satisfied. Basically, you're escaping life. You're escaping something. And this is what goes on in all addiction. So whether it's alcohol, whether it's drugs, whether it's the computer, games, whatever it really is, you're just hardwired to the pleasure. And that's what it is. The dopamine kicks in our brains, and then we just want more and more stimulation. Now, once that behavior kicks in, if you have what's called, biopsychosocial behavior, in other words, there's three things that lead to an addiction. If you have all three, then chances are highly likely that you will develop an addiction. And as you can see, most of us drink, and most of us drink just fine. There are even people that do drugs occasionally, and they doesn't mess up their lives. But we could use drugs and alcohol as an example. If there is a genetic component, then you may be more likely to be addicted. If there is a psychological component, in other words, you really feel that, this is going to make me feel good. So that could be with a drug, that could be with gambling. It's like, it's great. You will feel a greater high than somebody else that's much more cautious. And, of course, there's a social aspect of the addiction. And that's just being part of the crowd. So if there is a need to be part of the crowd, to just get away from yourself for a while, you feel, this is going to be really good. And, of course, if there's a genetic component and it happens to be you're talking about drugs and alcohol here, then, yes, you will be more susceptible to get an addiction than someone else who's just occasionally drinking. And it's not really sublimating their real need, which is really an escape from pressure, an escape from... as you mentioned, this particular boy escaped from the pressure of school, escaped from the pressure of university. There's so many other pressures. And just to, get onto Facebook, get on, to your friends, talk to people all over the world. You can just keep on going there, and it doesn't even have to be Facebook. It could be the BlackBerry. It could be the computer. We have so many different addictions out there, different escapes, where we just don't have to deal with the reality that's going on in our lives.
It's interesting. I was talking to my daughter today, and I was mentioning that we're going to be talking about overeating, and I said that's something that everyone seems to have not everyone, but many people have a problem with. And I mentioned the other was video games, but I thought that probably not that many people would be interested in that as much. And she said, no, I don't think so. As a matter of fact, and she has a couple of nephews, and they play video games a lot, and she knows some of her friends with children, and they all, the same thing. It's the question of when is something over the top? At what point do you say, I've got to put some controls and some limits in place, either for myself or for my children? And even sometimes perhaps for, sometimes children are concerned about what they see their parents doing.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, what happens is you're going to notice the person is spending more time doing a particular behavior than they are actually spending time with real people. So on interacting, they'll go into their rooms, they're on the computer. And I believe also your daughter is right to get back to that. There's a whole new generation of young adults that have been raised on games. So this isn't for kids anymore. The average game player is between 25 to 35 years old, and many play a few hours a week, and they don't have a problem. But what we're talking about is the 10 or 15% that do show specific signs of an addiction, as defined by the World Health Association, and these people don't, they're not playing the game anymore. They're in the game. They are absorbed by it. They can develop physical symptoms like carpal tunnel syndrome, migraine headaches. They have irregular eating. They lack hygiene. The game becomes their life. What happens here, there are these psychological symptoms that they all have, which is this high, like with all addictions. They feel amazing. And then they just feel that they cannot stop playing. I don't know if, Charles, you know some of these games up there, but some of them have, you have a much more creative life than you have in your real life. There are games like Second Life, where it actually is a second life. You have an avatar. You can be anyone. You can be anything. And you can play with other people all across the world. These friends can become more important to you than your actual real friends. So that's where the addiction kicks in, when it's something that you just feel drawn to all the time.
It's interesting. It sounds like a book I read many years ago, Brave New World, and this idea of just losing yourself in a hologram somehow, some way.
Yes, yes, yes. It's very much that.
Interesting. Well, again, so you're let's say you find yourself really enjoying these games, or you find yourself eating at night when you're not really hungry, but you just feel like, you know, it's just something to do, and you find you do find some pleasure in it, and you recognize, well, I'll make up for that by exercising tomorrow, or I'll play these games tonight, but I'll kind of leave it alone tomorrow. But then tomorrow comes and you don't really leave it alone, you don't stop eating. Again, is there some signal or something that people can catch themselves? The idea of the show that we have is really, when people are having feelings that are not right and they recognize they're not right, it's what can we tell people to help them to change those feelings? So if dopamine's getting produced, is there a different way to produce it so that they feel also some pleasure, but some other way?
Okay, sure. I'm going to talk in AA language because it's really pretty easy to do it, to explain it that way. It's quite simplistic. They use the word HALT. And when you're looking at that acronym, it's really hungry, angry, lonely, tired. In other words, when your body is at stress. So in other words, notice, why are you eating? Why are you hungry after you've eaten? It's not food that you're craving. Something must be going wrong. There's something that's drawing you to that refrigerator. So when you're going to go and you look at the word HALT, you can say, am I hungry? Well, no. Am I angry? Well, that would be a feeling. And am I angry? Well, maybe. Am I stressed? There's angry, lonely, there's nobody around, there's nothing to do, maybe I can eat, it just fills time. Tired, of course. The first thing we crave when we're tired is energy, and so we can look for carbs and or taste sensations like chips and, you know, sugars and starches. We never crave carrots for some reason, so it's always something negative. But there's so many other feelings like frustration and loneliness, though, is a huge one, particularly at night. If there's nothing to do and there's no one to talk to, or you're just plain bored, it fills a void. And that's what the computer does now 24/7. There are people that actually risk their jobs by just not going to work. They're just online all the time. And the same thing with food. They can be eating so much and feeling so bad the next day that they'll also miss work. And so you have to notice what you're doing. You are the key. And it's all emotion-based.
So the emotions that feed this, hunger, anger, loneliness, tiredness.
Angry, lonely, tired, and of course many, many more. But those are the keys.
And so you, let's say you recognize that you are feeling tired, and, you know, obviously the logical thing is then take a nap, go to bed. But if that's not an option, or you're just not ready, or you're still, you know, I know myself at the end of the evening, sometimes I'm feeling tired, but I'm too wired, if you will, to want to go to bed. And
right.
So what do you do instead? I guess that's part of the question I have is, so you find yourself, you recognize and you're aware now of this HALT and this acronym and the things that it means. And you're saying, yeah, that's me. I get that. I do feel those things. And it does lead to this impulsive behavior on my part. And so what do I do instead?
Well, it really depends on what the person would originally do. So, for instance, if you are escaping, let's say, to the computer, okay, and the computer is an easy one to use, or food is another easy one to use. But you go to the computer, and then what's happening is, let's say, everyone else is asleep, but you're hardwired to that computer. The computer becomes a stimulant. So what you have to do is you're recognizing, why are you on the computer? Well, let's say it's a computer game and you have friends you're talking to all over the world. Well, I have to be on at this time. We all rationalize that, you know, what we're doing is the right thing. I have to be on because these people are expecting me. They're expecting me to play the game. The bottom line is you have to really look at how much time are you spending on this computer. You are going to get cravings. You are going to say, I want to get back to the computer. I want to play this game. And you're going to justify that you should. This would be the same with the food. The food literally in the refrigerator, in the pantry, can be calling your name to the point of, oh, sometimes what the heck, I may as well take it anyway. Then what happens is the next day, if it's the computer, what happens, you're very tired the next day. Sometimes you really cannot go to sleep because now you're wired about the game and all you can be doing is thinking about the game. There's always somebody else that's going to tell you that something is going on, something is wrong. And what happens is then there is a breakdown. There's always an argument. The person will defend the argument. They literally say, well, you're crazy. Everybody does this. I'm fine. I can't sleep. Or in the case of food, though, they always say the next day it's going to be different. And then it isn't. It just leads on. And then there's this real feeling of defeat, as well as feeling stuffed, as well as that diet cycle up and down. The key is to just literally stop yourself. It's hard because what you're doing is you have to rewire. You have to rethink your behavior, and you're hardwired to do what you're used to doing, the pleasure. And it's only pleasurable in the immediate. After that, it becomes you feel terrible about what you've done. You've spent so much time, literally, if it's a game, doing nothing. And people will tell you. And so you also have to listen to what they're saying, you know, because our own brains don't say it. And that's the point. You're going to get arguments from partners. You get arguments from colleagues. If you're always, you know, at the computer, you can literally get fired. You know, or you could bring home binge foods specifically for that binge, feeling terribly, terribly guilty and very sick the next day. And
well, I was going to say that it seems to me that when you mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous, I have some friends that are in that. And one of the things that they have is they have partners or mentors or coaches, and they have buddies that somehow they call or they're supposed to check in with to see how the other person's doing. But as soon as they feel that urge somehow, they're instructed to reach out to someone before they act on it. And then when you said that you have the food calling your name from your refrigerator, I wonder if you can train yourself to think that it's calling somebody else's name.
That would be great.
Yeah, I'm working here with my friend Lou. I'm going to start telling myself that it's they're calling Lou's name at my own.
Well, one of the keys, though, really, is instead of thinking of the pleasure, think of the worst. Think of the pain. Think of how you feel, because you're always going to be hardwired to the pleasure. So when you're thinking of, what's in that pantry, think literally, put in the mind, how did you feel when you ate this last? How are you going to feel tomorrow? And very often that can cut a craving. This would be with any addiction, because once you're getting into it, you know, it's like, oh, I'm going to just have one chip or two chips. It's not going to happen if you're not used to having a little handful of chips. You're going to finish the bag. Then how do you feel, and where will it go from chips? So if you think of the negative, and that would be with any addiction. It could be thinking. It could be with drugs. It could be with alcohol, gambling. When you have that crash, you don't think of it when you're going for it. You're only thinking of how great it's going to be. But it's the crash. If you force yourself to think of the crash, it can be a complete turnoff, and it can be really helpful.
So some of this, it seems to me, it's, when I'm doing executive coaching with people, and I'm talking, or any time I'm teaching the concept of dealing differently with emotions, what I instruct people is two things. One is that you want to understand how emotions work, and that's part of it, and that's the science. But you also want to understand how you behave and what works for you. And one of the things I've asked people to think about is, have you ever had success breaking, for instance, if you've got an addiction now, but you've had a different addiction in the past and you were successful in shutting that other addiction off, was there something that worked for you then that might be useful to you now?
Well, that's what we call cross addictions. And what happens, and I can use that very much for an example, for instance, with I stopped smoking cigarettes, for instance, and now I'm eating a lot more, you know, that kind of thing. Or any type of behavior, you know, not drinking, but gambling. You know, what you're doing is you're escaping from the emotion into something else. The behavior has changed, but the person has not really change his behavior. They've just changed the addiction. So they're still not dealing with the problem.
So that's interesting. So they really haven't been successful then. They've just substituted one addiction for another.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hmm. And are there such things as addictive personalities? It seems to me I've run across people in my life that seem to get addicted to almost anything that they do.
Yeah.
And others who seem like they can try everything and nothing seems to become addictive for them.
Well, that's the stimulation. If you are wired to the stimulation, yes, then you're always looking for something. But there's addictions that are okay. I mean, I wouldn't call them addictions because if they are, you know, obsessions, they're really not okay. But, for instance, if you're going to be doing anything to an excess, it's not okay. However, you can still get a rush. There are a lot of people that just love that. A runner gets a high, and then you can do that obsessively, but you can spend it productively, taking care of your health, running, getting a high, doing exercise, all that kind of thing. Doing sports is another rush. A lot of people, you know, love to join teams. I mean, it's all about that. Or even individual sports. You know, those are all really positive ways to get a rush. It's the negative. If you have what they called an addictive personality, it's really you just want stimulation. You want more stimulation. And so you'll be a little bit more wired to something that's stimulating.
That's interesting. If you find that you're not sports able for whatever reason, are there other kinds of things that you would consider positive obsessions that are addictions and that are healthier than others for you?
Well, I guess anything that you really are excited about and that you can get involved in. I mean, people call, you know, people use workaholism as an addiction. A lot of people get very well compensated for, you know, that addiction, if you will. But what happens is, as far as their personal life is concerned, it does not work. So you have to look for a balance somewhere. But, you know, anything that you have a passion for, you just have to balance.
Hmm. And it seems to me that I've found people sometimes that produce a lot of writings that others have said they're obsessive, but they're obsessive because they've produced a lot of research, or they've produced a lot of fiction books that people enjoy reading. Or again,
right.
It seems like there are some other places or ways. It's not so much that you shut off all kinds of compulsive or obsessive behavior,
exactly,
as much as you try and channel it in a way that's constructive, I guess.
Exactly. And also, you cannot do this only as your only part of your life. You have to balance it. So in other words, you can't leave your family, you can't bury yourself in that, because that is the escape, and that becomes the addictive component. So as long as you're balancing it, you can, you know, and it doesn't mean that you have to stop and say, okay, now it's family time, it's this time, it's that time. You have to have your recreational time, but you also have to have your balance, and as well as your passion. You know, so in other words, you need a full life.
Well, let me ask you this balance question, because, again, another strategy that I've heard around compulsive behavior like this, or addictive behavior, is, you know what, I'm not going to eat ice cream until the weekend, mm-hmm, or something that, you know, postpones that gratification for another day. But then that day comes, and then it's a binge kind of day. And
yeah.
is there any kind of alternative that does make sense that works like that?
Well, an alternative to the binge?
Well, an alternative that allows you to enjoy some of the pleasures that you really love, but you don't want to, you know, as soon as you...
Oh, sure.
It's kind of like, can I eat one chip? No. But can I eat a bunch of chips on just one day?
Sure. There are strategies with that. If you're an emotional eater, what you do is you do not bring your trigger foods home. That's for sure. You can bring them. Let's say there are guests and you want to have cake and ice cream and whatever. You can bring them. It's fine. You can even take, but you take. Don't do secret eating. Eat with people. And then what you do is you make sure that there is none of that food in the house. You give it away. You give it to friends. You bring family members, people that are there, and say, no, we don't want to eat it. And that's really what it is. If you say to yourself, I cannot give it away. This is really not for me. It's for the kids, or it's for my husband, or whatever. What happens is you're lying to yourself. You're not ready to do that yet. Because once you are ready, then you can leave it in the fridge and not take it. But for a long time, you're going to be hardwired to, okay, just a little bit for me, and before you know it, you know, the gallon of ice cream is gone. And then you feel terrible. So what you do is you don't deprive yourself from the ice cream, but what you do, go out and have a portion of ice cream, and then you don't bring it into the house, and that's it. You know, go to restaurants, enjoy, but then you don't continue just because there's this feeling that this is a good food and this is a bad food. As soon as you start going into the positive and negative, anything that we mustn't have is the one thing that we want. So that's where the craving comes in. So it's almost like, I already had ice cream. So, you know what? Doesn't really matter. So I'm going to come home and have cookies. And what the heck? I may as well have chips, too, and peanuts, and keep on going, you know? So it's not. It's just because you had ice cream doesn't mean that you have to break this diet. It's not a diet. It's life. You're living with this food. You have to learn how to live with it, much like alcohol, too. In the beginning, you have to say no alcohol in the house. Later, you can go to a party and have alcohol, and it doesn't mean that you have to drink it. And it doesn't mean that everyone around you doesn't have to drink it. You know, you become just more cautious of what your triggers are, and so you don't go there. It's like a diabetic. You cannot have certain foods, so what you do is you don't have them. But you can't think of yourself as being deprived, as not being able to have them, because if you feel deprived, that's what's going to get you. You're going to want it.
Interesting. One of the things I was thinking as you were talking is Many years ago, I did have an addiction to cigarettes, and so I have had that experience of being addicted to something and found it very difficult to break the addiction. But I think that for those who have never been addicted, they don't probably understand how someone can become addicted. And I wonder if when we're talking about this, I'm thinking for those people who have never been addicted to anything and have never experienced it, they're looking at other people and saying, why don't they just stop?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it doesn't make any sense. It also doesn't make sense to the addict, too, but it's not as easy as that. Who was it? Was it Nancy Reagan that said, just don't do drugs?
Just say no, right?
Just say no, something like that, yes. Well, that's not the best advice because everybody knows it, first of all, and if they could stop, they would stop. So it's much bigger than that. I've heard it said by, for instance, gamblers that play the machines, it's like, I don't understand why I can't get off the machine. I'm crazy. Okay, I'm just crazy. What is going on? Why can't a grown person walk away from a machine? Okay, this is the addiction. This is not the machine. This is their mind. This is all they want to do is escape, as we were talking about. And food, for instance, is an escape. It's escape from what? You know, drugs, of course, there's the chemical addiction, but there's also, it starts with an escape. It starts with fun. I want to have fun. And they're all thinking of, party, fun, never thinking that, this party for them has lasted too long. So what goes on here is there is the perception that all you have to do is stop. You know, I've had, parents saying, well, just don't bring a bottle. Don't bring the bottle home. Well, if they're not going to bring the bottle home, what's going to happen is they're going to drink it outside or they're going to hide bottles. But it's your brain that's playing games with you. And that's the escape. That's what the addiction is about. So you could say, just don't do it. Then you will get a tremendous craving because it's, I want it. I want it. I'm going to have it. I'm going to do it. And that is such a problem, though, Charles, because people around the person with the problem can do really nothing about it. The frustration is huge. It's like, stop, stop. Well, they want to stop, particularly, you know, after they've had a binge or after they've had a crash. But the addict is the only person that has the control of that.
That's interesting. That is another question that I had for you before we break, Bev. That is, what happens to people who see someone that they love engaging in addictive behavior? Is there any guidance that you might be able to give? Because it seems to me there's an enormous sense of urgency to jump in and say something, do something to try and save someone that you love that you see going down a very difficult and a problem-laden road.
Yes. Well, there's very little that you can really do, but there is something that you can do that can make things a lot worse, and this is really what happens. You cannot stop the addict from doing whatever defeating behavior they do. However, I mean, short of, if it's a gambler, you have the credit cards, and, you handle that. If it's alcohol, you really cannot control somebody as far as their drinking is concerned. There's very little you could do. There's always a way, even without credit cards. You know, the gambler will get involved with loan sharks. There's always a way. The only thing that you can do is not enable them. And enabling, people believe that when you're helping somebody, you're doing it for them, you're making it simpler for them, but that's really considered enabling if they're capable of doing it themselves. So let's use drinking for an example. If the person has a hangover the next day and you're calling in sick for that person or you're lying for that person, you're not really helping them. The addict has to suffer consequences, and that's where it's just so difficult for somebody who loves somebody that to watch them suffer. And addicts can be extremely manipulative, very nasty, and they are incapable very often. But they're the ones that have to have that consequence. Otherwise, why should anybody change? And so enabling anyone with an addiction is really the worst thing. It just prolongs the addiction. It prolongs the behavior. So the idea is no. If a kid can't go to school the next day because, you know what, he's been smoking pot and he's skipped a lot of classes, you know, to scream, to yell, to push him out the door, to go to class, you know, there's very little you can do. He can walk out the door, but will he go to class? Is he going to do the work? Who knows? But he's got to suffer the consequences.
That's almost counterintuitive. You know, it's someone you love, and yet what you're doing is allowing them to suffer some consequences that they need to suffer in order to feel the pain associated with enough pain, and sometimes pain is great enough to cause change to happen by itself.
Well, what it also does, that's so true, but what it also does is it points the problem to the person. So, in other words, if you don't have the consequence, it allows you to continue. But what happens is if you do have the consequences, like this is your fault, not my fault, and it's so particularly difficult when there is, you know, you're involved in that person's life. In other words, if there's a partner that's supposed to be going to work and he keeps on missing work, you will be suffering the consequences if he loses his job. So what happens is naturally you're going to pick up for this person. However, the idea is, you have to have your own life. Everybody that's with an addict cannot lose their identity in that addiction. What happens is the family really becomes a very dysfunctional family, and it's led by the addict, and because it's something that you just keep in the closet. So what happens is you have to be an individual here. Each and every one has to get on with their own lives. This is where Al-Anon is very, very helpful. Just explains that they really are not capable of taking care of that addict. The addict has to do it themselves. It helps you stay strong, to keep your own identity, to stop enabling, and that would be on any level. GA, CA, Al-Anon works for all of that.
So it's Al-Anon being the for the people who are spouses
families.
Or family members who addicts in their family.
Yes. And, of course, there's also counseling. I have information on my website.
Why don't you tell people about, you know, I'm assuming that there are people that are listening to you, Bev, and, you know, there are very few of us that are untouched by addiction someplace in our lives, either with ourselves or with people that we know. In fact, one person just called in and said that there's no such thing as a person who's not addicted to something. At least
Charlie.
Okay. That's his experience, at least. And
I sort of tend to agree. Mm-hmm. With me, it would be food. Mm-hmm. I'm not overweight, but I watch it.
Yeah, I'm not overweight either, but I can watch a gallon of ice cream disappear.
absolutely. You know, and so, hungry, angry, lonely, tired relates to me, too.
That's very interesting. So I'm not sure if people are going to call you now, but...
No, I would agree that, you know, we can so easily get into an obsession, you know, and whether it's obsession with plastic surgery, which has now become huge, and, you know, there's just so many things to escape into. Although, you know, I have not dealt in plastic surgery addiction, but definitely the gaming addiction is very, very big. And
well, you also, I saw on your website, you deal with sex addiction as well, I saw.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that happens to a lot of people?
Yes. And I don't want to bring Tiger Woods into it, but because who knows what was going on there. But yes, sex is a high. It's definitely a rush. And people that do suffer sex addiction, it's not... You know, I've heard so many times, well, that's an addiction I want. But that's not what a sex addict would say. There's a lot of pain here. What it is multiple partners, and they're doing really risky behavior, and they can have a perfectly normal life on the one hand, and on the other hand, they have a whole secret world, and they suffer. They have pain like everyone else in any other addiction. But why am I doing this? I can get caught. I can get disease. I have risky behavior. I have a good relationship. But like I said in the beginning, they're escaping problems. They've learned somewhere along the line that sex was a great escape, and they'll just continue. And that's, yeah, it's not pleasure. It's literally they cannot stop.
Let me ask
they
you.
They also have their specific, in the addiction model with drugs and alcohol, they'd say drug of choice. They also have their behavior of choice. So whether it's the girly bars or whether it's, you know, the internet or whatever, it's all, you know, or dates, it's all dependent on what they have escaped into.
Very interesting. So my friend Lou has a question for you.
Sure.
How about hoarders? Now, that's a very personal, very pressing issue that is very prevalent, but we don't hear too much about it. But there are laws that that govern that sort of behavior. In other words, it's incumbent upon you by law, if you know something about someone who's doing something that's like hoarding and is causing danger or creating a dangerous environment for a pet or a family member, we're obligated, you know, at some point. There's laws on the books. What about hoarders?
Okay, you know, I missed that word. This line isn't very clear, but what was that? What about?
Hoarders.
What are you talking about, Lou? Hoarding what?
Hoarders.
Yes.
Okay. I thought you were saying quarters. I couldn't get that.
You
okay.
You need quarters? I have a quarter. Wait a minute.
That's right. Rest, what addiction is that? Go for dollars. hoarders. That's definitely a compulsive behavior. It's kind of sad. It's almost like you cannot throw, well, it's not almost, you cannot throw anything away. It's a feeling that I'm going to need it next time. It's totally anxiety-based, which is really all these addictions. The thing with hoarders is they really don't let you into their house. They keep their world very private. They cannot throw anything away. They get tremendous anxiety if they don't keep it. And so, you know, I don't know if people like they do have on, the, you know, these television shows with, you know, these strange addictions where they're living in a house. That's a whole other thing. Okay, that kind of behavior is beyond simple hoarding. But there are people that really cannot clean up the house. They go from room to room, and closets get filled with all kinds of junk. And to throw things out, no. It's like, what if I need it again? I may need it. And as soon as I throw something out, I will need it. It becomes, like all addictions, arguments in the family. People shut down. You become very closed and don't allow people, you know, into your house. And then there's, like every other addiction, there's the guilt. Why can't I be just like other people? You know, even calling in somebody okay, there is a problem, and, you know, I'm going to have somebody clean this whole place out and sort it and put it in bins. It doesn't happen. Because they can't throw anything out, they won't allow anyone else to throw it out, and even if it's all sorted and put in bins, it will bother them. They go back to the old behavior of clutter.
So
clutter makes them feel good. It's a comfort.
Before we run out of time, I wanted to just ask you, if assuming that someone did want to contact you, is it possible to work with you long distance? Because I know you're in
sure.
Canada, and you want to just say a little bit about how to get in touch with you, and also just what people might expect, because I'm assuming that there's plenty of people listening and saying, you know what, I'm borderline, when they may or may not be borderline, and they're thinking that I have one or all of those issues. And so the question becomes, so is there really someone that can help me? And I believe that you can. So you want to tell them about how they might contact you and what they might expect?
Sure. I have a website. It's untwistyourthinking.com. And I can be reached on the website. And if they want to talk to me or ask a question, you can always ask a question. If you want, we could do coaching and, you know, you can get a free half hour to find out if you like that sort of thing, because I speak to people all over the world. But you can also ask, you know, ask a question and as well as, you know, tell your story. Because what happens is in any of these behaviors, you feel so isolated, you feel so alone. So if you can share your story, other people also just love to hear that story because it's all so similar. And then you feel, you know, I'm not alone and there is help for me. So if anyone is interested, there's all kinds of information on that website, untwistyourthinking.com, and you can certainly reach me and ask me whatever questions you need, and I'll be glad to help.
Thank you so much, Bev. I really appreciate your spending some time with us on the phone.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.